Hello and welcome to Dial F for Flanger, which is a it's basically a pop culture comic podcast chat thing where I talk to interesting people about interesting things. And I'm doing my first returning guest. So these gentlemen, they did a comic. They were on my first episode. Their comic was called Compass. It came out from Image Comics. They also got published in The Old Guard, Tales Through Time, if I've got the title correctly. But we're on the other side of their comic release now. So they are about to bring out their trade paperback of Compass. So let's welcome Robert and Dave. So Robert McKenzie and Dave Walker, the writers of Compass. How are you, gentlemen? And how are you finding your success at this point? So Robert, you want to start?
Sure. I mean, the limo broke down on the way to the podcast and I had to take the helicopter. But other than that, look, it obviously we're delighted to have it out there in the world and be done. And, you know, the most important thing to us is that people who pick up the story enjoy it, and so far from what we understand, although there could be a vast silent majority who do not want to speak to us, the majority of people who've read it have liked it. So in that sense, we feel very gratified by kind of having it out there. Now it's going well.
Yeah, it's exciting. Writers copies arrived in the post, and that box is much bigger for the trade, I have learned, which is really exciting to just see it in the flesh, put it on the shelf. No other people out there will soon get to see it. It's a weird and good milestone.
Yeah, having it complete is very different in the sense that there is, to presage your point, there is content in the individual issues that is not in the trade. There is content in the trade that is not in the individual issues, because we wanted a bit of a value add for people who came along the journey with us to start with. But also we wanted to put in some bonus content for people who were happy to come in twice. But there is something kind of complete about seeing it in a totality where it's a book rather than individual issues. And you go, oh, yes, this tome that was put together. Now, tome is, it's 128 pages or whatever it is, so it's not War and Peace. But there is something nice about seeing it laid out as a complete story. Eric, who does our graphic design, has done a phenomenal job in kind of putting it together, and it feels like it would be a good addition to any bookshelf from 16th of January, so next week.
Speaking of which, our next project, have you considered a graphic novel adaptation of War and Peace?
I mean, it could be done. In fact, it would shock me if it's not one of those illustrated comic classics or something nowadays. But what you do is you got to reskin it slightly so it's like War and Peace with robots or rats or something. You know, Mouse Guard style, or we're giving away the keys to the kingdom now, because now I'm actually starting to think about this. And if we come up with it on the podcast, it'll broadcast before we've had any chance to write it, and some other clever person will.
I have the twist for you. What about doing it with tennis players and a legal system?
Look, I just did 20 minutes while we were waiting for Dave to join the call. Do we need to do this again? as three Australians on a world-spanning podcast, obviously, that's a Novak Djokovic reference. I'm going to refrain from public comment, even within the guise of the comic book chat. But, you know, draw your own conclusions about what a failure to make a public statement may mean about, you know, this situation.
Well, I mean, it's a situation that has legs, and it's clearly because nothing else is happening in the world or in Australia that's more important than whether a millionaire can play tennis. So
Nothing's more important in this country, Paul, than what's going on with sports, ever. up to and including, we could have an alien invasion to perform open-heart surgery on the entirety of the population in a non-sterile environment while everyone was on fire, and people would still ask about the cricket scores. So it goes.
Yeah. Anyway, I really enjoyed the comic. Technically I'll be a triple dipper, because I bought some of the issues digitally as they were coming out because I wanted to read them immediately. I got them from the comic shop within a few days or a week or so later because of comic deliveries in Australia during a pandemic. And I'm also going to buy the trade. So Yeah, well done. And it's certainly something that I'm looking forward to reading in one hit, because you, if you read something monthly, it's a different experience. I mean, I had the experience recently where I read a comic and it had been colorized. I'd only ever read it in black and white, and it was like reading something completely different. But this isn't that, so but similar, as in, you know, if you read something all in a row, you're getting all the hits and the lead up, and it stays in your brain a lot more vehemently. So how did you find the public reaction to the comic? What was some of the surprising things that people said about it? And as we go further into this podcast, we will move into more spoilers about your story. But yeah, what was really surprising about audience responses?
So I don't know if it's surprising, because to call this surprising would be deeply patronizing, but something I found incredibly interesting is just how well-informed and well-educated a lot of the people who got in touch with us are about the sorts of things we're writing about. You know, 13th century Golden Caliphate in Wales are things we needed to research quite intently to feel competent putting pen to paper. And the number of people who wrote in with interesting questions and comments and thoughts and angles and insights about that sort of thing was one of those, was just a really kind of cool part of the conversation in the broader feedback for me. So yeah, that was neat.
Okay, well, just we'll lay this all out at this point in the podcast so people aren't going, what? Just in case they're unfamiliar with Compass. So it's in the 13th century. Shahadar is your protagonist, and she is a scholar, and sort of in the Indiana Jones adventuring template, without the white supremacy side. She has a frenemy called Ling, who is also a similar passion, and but working for the bad guys, and the bad guys are the Golden Horde, who are Mongol lepers, or led by Mongol lepers.
So we should be specific on that point, because that's actually something we really wanted to be clear about, and it comes up in some of the material that surrounds the book, is that summary is accurate, save to the extent that the character of Margul Shagdur, who represents the key head of the villainish team in this piece, if you want to put it that way, is out on a frolic of his own. It's not suggested necessarily that the Golden Horde is all composed of violent, sadistic, troubled people in that way. To the opposite extent, it's a question of what we tried to do when writing all of the cultures that are within the piece is present them through a modernist lens, and particularly because of the way in which we've tried to focus things, Shahida and the House of Wisdom and what's going on in Baghdad and what's going on in China in the period and what's happening with the rise of Mongols is not intended to be, I guess, the way it is often presented as the exotic, or in the case of the Mongols, particularly barbarous East. They are empires doing what empires do. Where the story diverges in this sense from history, and it does in a lot of different ways, but it presupposes that there are good and bad actors within that kind of ordinary cultural framework who are doing things, rather than the culture itself is driven to extremes. Because ultimately, one of the points that we were hoping to make, for good or ill, is that actually the 13th century world was closer in its assessments of how things are to the modern world than you may think, particularly when you move out of Western Europe, where medieval thought was quite different to the way in which we think now, and start moving towards the East, and some of the ways in which scientific method and philosophy and cultural structure were different, and ultimately, whilst not exactly the same as modernist thought, were understandable from the perspective that we move on to today. So I guess that's a long way of saying hashtag not all Mongols, but you know,
you beat me to it.
Yeah. But yeah, no, that's a fair assessment. And they are off in Wales for the purposes of this story, chasing the Cauldron of Eternal Life, which gives the first volume its name.
Did you find this was a particularly cultural minefield for you to dance through, or was it fairly straightforward and your research really got it okay for you?
I don't think minefield's the right way to look at these sorts of things, in the sense that it's not about danger to us. You know, as a writer, that you want to do a good job, you want to make sure you're respectful of all the different things that you are invoking and including. And certainly there was a lot of enjoyable labor, but labor that goes into that, that we both had to do. It's one of those things when you decide to have a protagonist who in some key ways is like you, but in some very key ways is not. You know, when you're writing for another religion, when you're writing for another gender, when you are including, you know, the past is a different country, when you're trying to just write an entirely different world as things existed back there, it is one of those things where you just need to put that effort in and take that care. But I've always found that to be its own reward as well. I mean, you may have guessed by our long-winded answers, we are nerds, and so the ability to read and to talk to people about these sorts of things and to get other points of view and to blend them into the work is its own fun.
One of the things that we tried to do with this too, that's worth, and it's tonally true of the whole comic, and it is part of what we were trying to do with the entire exercise, and what we have to hope for is that people came along with us on the journey for this, is that we explicitly departed not from history, but from the tone of history, I guess, or from the tone in the way in which these things are presented. So by that, what I mean is the idiom in which people speak, the way in which people speak in the comic, is not the way in which people would have spoken in the 13th century by any stretch of the imagination, right? Because it's got punchy 1-2 dialogue informed by modern screenwriting and modern comics and all the rest of that stuff. But the point is, what we wanted to represent by doing that is what it would have felt like to have that conversation then using the language of now. So it's designed to center the audience in the experience of the people. And that meant that the characters needed to be really authentically put together. And then we could apply this kind of framework of, this is what it would sound like to the modern ear. There's a writer called Gene Wolfe, who we both like a lot, who's a science fiction writer. And I mean, that's a reductivist way to describe Gene Wolfe. Everybody should read Gene Wolfe. He's great, but he's also quite complex. And one of the conceits that he uses in a lot of his books is that what you are reading is not the narrative as it occurred. It is the narrative translated for the way in which you could hear it as best it occurred. So the most prime example of that is he's got a series called The Book of the New Sun, which is sort of either one novel or four novels, depending how you look at it, the way you can with sci-fi fantasy stuff. And in that, there is no fictional language used at all, but what he uses is incredibly archaic language to describe basically sci-fi concepts. And the conceit there is that, you know, he takes a 8th century word or a 4th century BC word and uses that in that context and goes, actually, that's how far back the concept you would be thinking of would be to the people who are in the story. And I'm using this to ground it in your language so you get the sense of what this is and where that was. And we tried to take, I guess, the opposite approach and take a very 21st century patter dialogue and insert it over the rubric of, no, these are 13th century struggles.
So, I mean, it's the equivalent of using explosions in space to say this is exciting, you know?
Yeah, exactly right. You know, that's a much probably better way of putting it, is that, you know, Star Wars does dogfights in space with explosions and cool laser noises and trench runs which operate on a 2D platform, even though they're in three-dimensional space, because that visual language is about, this is what a fight between ships/planes looks like. And that helps the audience interpret the emotions and what's going on in the story and everything else. And that's what we were trying to borrow from here, I guess.
Now, how much of the heavy lifting did Justin Greenwood, your artist, have to do as far as the look and feel and, you know, people running around with halberds or spears and things like that? How much did he have to do, or did you contribute a lot of that to him? And what did he do that, you know, stunned you guys apart from every single page?
So the, you know, way of working, the back and forth means that, you know, the same sort of attitude and approach that Robert was just talking about with the writing, he was able to take to the art. So, you know, he would draw it in his style. You know, the historical accuracy was important, but it wasn't the kind of thing where we were requiring or he was expecting, you know, intensive research. It was more about catching the spirit and the feel of the thing, you know, creating the fantastical elements of the world, the visual language for it like that. You know, Shahidar's cool technology, the sort of weirdness of the underground layer and that sort of stuff. You know, all both were really cool to me, but also was the way that he was able to bring his previous experience with doing things like historical art and so on into this particular story. You know, giving it a bit of freewheeling fun was a big part of the point of the thing, particularly with the art as well.
We hadn't worked with Justin before this, and one of the great virtues of doing it the way that one of the great virtues of doing sequential narratives is the first issue was quite not tentative, but it was, you know, here's some stuff we're hoping to lay out and maybe you should consider this and here's some reference and stuff like that. By issue two, I think we just said something like, you know what to do here, here's four pages, we're going to get out of your way, and then we'll put some dialogue in as we go. And that's one of the great collaborating elements of comics, is that the storytelling is visual, and so it's not just a matter of us laying something out and then telling him to execute it. It's much more he gets to run, as he should, those storytelling elements where we go, we need to get the characters from position A to position B. How best do we represent that? And you know, give him full freight to do it. So 90 to 100% of the work, in answer to your previous question, is all Justin. He sort of carried us on his wings for a lot of this.
When something was, you know, of historical importance or specificity, you'd really just kind of go into some length in the script about why and how and what it looks like, and he'd always hit that out of the park first try.
Did you present any particular problems to your editor, Alejandro Arbona?
I mean, we talk a lot, and that doesn't drop away in emails. You will have picked this up on podcast two now, so I suspect the primary problem we represented is that he would ask a fairly simple question, and we would bombard him with long form answers that he would then wade through. But I would also be remiss if I didn't say and carry the Aussie flag for a minute. We drove him and some of our production staff a bit around the bend with U's in color and honor and S's instead of Z's and whatnot. So in that sense, we carried a particular cultural handicap for which we can only apologize.
Anything to add there, Dave?
Just the fact that there are two of us, I think, was its own challenge as well. He'd ask a question like, should this be blue or green? And I'd say blue, and Robert would say green, and then 2 days later, he'd have an answer to his basic question.
I mean, that's always the challenge with co-writing, is that you either have the option of saying, we'll go away and talk about it, and then it takes however long for you guys to come to a consensus decision that it takes, or you do it publicly and have the debate there when it happens. And, you know, we're a fairly tight-knit, close team. We all like each other and we get on very well, so we tend to just do that. But that does mean that there's some pretty choice email threads about what would notionally be minor issues where we go around and around and around again to try and land on what we think is best. You know, there's probably a 100 email chain about a single panel, which I can think of, and whether or not we were all satisfied with it, where it fit in the story and everything else.
Well, that's very impressive that you actually got the comic done.
I suppose that's true. we beat our own essential measure. No, I mean, when it's coming well, it comes very well, is the answer to the question. And I don't mean that in terms of quality. I hope you all like it, but that's not a big note of, oh, well, we're such geniuses that when it all flows. But when we're in a rhythm, it comes quickly, for good or ill. And so, you know, we can bang the scripts out fairly swiftly and then spend all that time that we make up in getting it done rapidly in editing and cross-posting and arguing about little bits. And part of it is also that when you've got a long-form rapport like Dave and I do, it's easy to get into arguing about the minutiae because you hit the big notes together really quickly. You know, it's not uncommon for Dave and I to get on the same page by saying we need to do the thing that's like the thing in exactly that language, and we'll both get it, and it'll kind of go from there.
So, in as far as your storytelling, was it a process of, simplifying to clarify, and, you know, was your earlier scripts more complex? I mean, did you, was your wordiness evident earlier, or, you know, did it flow pretty naturally because you have a pretty good understanding of what a comic should be?
So I would like to say the latter, but I suspect there's a little bit of the former bleeding through into it. You know, this was our first creator-owned. We've done work in the field before, obviously, so we were coming into it with a much more solid idea than our probably first round of relatively punishing scripts would have been a few years ago. But part of that comes down to that rapport issue that I was talking about before with Justin, is that when you know somebody, it's much easier to just go, we want it like this, or what do you think it should be like, and they get something quickly. So I'd say that they're fairly punchy scripts. If we ever publish the hardback with a script example in it, you know, Alan Moore, we don't do 6 pages of description to get a couple of panels in. We get out of the way of it. But there's a lot more of the stuff that appears as reference material in the back of the book that doesn't go into the scripts but forms part of conversations and things like that, so we ground it in context.
And your comic comes out under the banner Greg Rucker Presents. Was, how did Greg just lurk over the project as a sort of presence, giving example by his previous work? Or was he, you know, getting out and saying, I love this, I hate this, what about this?
Oh, he was a contributor to that 100 email thread that Robert referenced. He definitely was quite happy to provide contributions, even if they sometimes did boil down to as simple as, you know, whichever you pick now. But he was a very strong mentoring figure through the process, lent his ear and his eye, and walked us through it that sort of way. You know, our scripts, Alejandro's editing, but certainly from a kind of creative vision point of view, he was always happy to chip in.
And he refers to this in the introduction, so I don't think he'll mind us saying it, is that one of his principal tasks is to tell us when to shut up. and he does that very well, and he does that with all the love in the world, which is why it's nice to receive, is he can kind of go, no, you can stop polishing it now. It's done. This has met a satisfactory level. You should let it go and not worry at it quite so much. And that's an invaluable service.
At the convention where I met Greg, and he was basically sitting alone for a long stretch, I monopolized his time, and, you know, I would describe him as very generous as far as what he shared and how he shared it, and, you know, just taking time to, you know, he entertained me and he answered my questions about, you know, 52 and DC and all that sort of stuff in a very generous way. So I imagine as being involved as a collaborator is, you know, an extension and, you know, of that sort of attitude that he has.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. In that sense, he's a lovely guy. But I think the other thing is he was also audience number one in a way. He'd go, I've read your work and here's what I like about it as a Compass fan. And, you know, just that sort of early feedback about what's good, what's fun, what resonates with someone who isn't kind of us goes a long way to helping you shape plotting and that sort of stuff. You know, a lot of the second issue I wrote in Greg's basement while I was kind of visiting America back in the old days, when you could actually visit a place other than your house with the door locked and, you know, apocalypse supplies stacked in the kitchen. And so, you know, back there, I was kind of like, we've done the first issue. I have no idea where this goes next. I think we've made a terrible error. And you just can calmly go, that's called plotting, you know. Try again.
Yeah.
Wow. So as far as I think we'll move into sort of spoiler territories. Your story was laid out. Was there anything that someone noticed on the cover that was, and then raised with you, that was awkward at any stage? He said wink.
Yeah, I thought we would get here. So spoilers on, and hopefully you've all had a chance to read it by now if you're listening to this, or you're going to go pick up the trade and you don't mind about mild spoilers, but...
Or hit pause.
Yeah, or hit pause and come back in umpteen minutes, is that there is a dinosaur in the comic that is referred to as the dragon for reasons relating to eternal life. And that was actually the moment, I don't know if you were driving towards this earlier, Paul, but it's certainly true,
yeah.
Where I was most worried that we would lose the audience, because we tried very hard to take a sort of natural realist approach. You know, there's obviously fantasy elements in the story, but we were building it up very slowly from just a medieval adventure into something a little bit more fantastical. And then I'm like, and dinosaur. Are we going to lose everybody in issue 4? And certain people, who shall remain nameless, did kind of publicly call out, hang on a minute, what's that on the cover there? Can you talk to us about what we're seeing? And I'm like, shut up. I don't want to give this away. But what was hugely gratifying, and this is one of the points that I think is worth addressing, is, man, everybody swallowed the hook on that one, as far as we can tell. I mean, maybe, again, some people hated it and didn't tell us, but people who tagged us in reviews or stopped us to tell us about it or stuff like that really liked that. That's where we got to. And so the gamble kind of paid off in that sense. We certainly liked it. We found it a really fun conceit to do, but we weren't quite sure whether or not people would swallow it. And it turns out that they did, which is great. And I suppose just goes to show you that if you ground the first round of stuff in something that's historically and emotionally realistic, you can do. Check it out. There's a 65 million year old thing under a Welsh hill that they call the dragon that will eat you.
I think it also goes to show that if you're trying to slip a dragon in, you can't put it on the cover. Just throwing it out there as a learning we have for next time.
I agree with that. For what it's worth, we got to think. Like, I mean, it's great because it's certainly intrigued. This goes to your question about to what degree do we get out of Justin's way, right? Because Justin does the covers, obviously, and we have very limited input in that because he's already drawn the main issue and does the script and everything else, and we just want to see with great excitement as fans what he's going to put up on the table. But ultimately, his storytelling instincts there proved to be the correct one because it was just silhouetted enough for everybody to go, wait a minute, is that? And then that actually built a degree of excitement around it that we were not expecting, and that's great. I mean, you know, that's why he's a genius, and we're very lucky to have him.
Worth saying when we're talking about the covers that Justin does them with Brad Simpson, and that gives them some of their sparkle.
Yeah, Brad does particularly the colors, and you know, that's one of my favorite surprises on the book is that when we started, we didn't know we would be lucky enough to have Brad aboard. And some of the depths of color and the way it looks as a five-issue set next to each other, because Justin's done kind of a rolling panoramic, I was going to say triptych, but I forget what that is for five. Is it a quintic? Of images. So they all join together. Watching that with the color flow through it and everything else is just beautiful. Like, we're very... very pleased with how that all turned out.
I must admit, I did, when I got the last issue, I did lay them all out on the floor and went, ooh.
Yeah, clever. Working towards a plan. but you know, we're happy to have eagle-eyed viewers like yourself kind of get involved in the... Like, nothing's more exciting than having people get involved in the conversation. And if there's any message that I want to go out from the podcast, it's this... We're hungry for your engagement. Please come talk to us. As you can probably tell, you're not going to get kind of coolly aloof writer, oh, I don't discuss my work or my methods or anything like that. If you've got questions or comments or anything, hit us up, even if it's vitriol. Not too vitriolic, but you know, we can take some knocks. We would love to hear from anybody who's read it or is involved with it, because we're just so excited to share it with everybody.
Well, I'd like to pitch that in the next story, Shahadar finds a giant penny.
Oh, man, I'm so tempted. That's so good. And it's not, like, we've started breaking down the next one. And, look, a penny is a bit rough, but we could almost get within striking distance, I feel. Like, just slowly building up the relics of the Batcave does feel like it'd be a fun bit. Yeah. No, we'll think about it. We'll give it some due consideration.
All right. Latching onto those words, next one. Anything you can share at this point? Or?
I mean, no is the short answer. We have ideas. We have too many ideas. The slow process of boiling it down is underway. But obviously, the trade's not even out yet. I'm sure the conversations with the creative team and Image and everyone else will be ongoing after we get to the other side of that and get to do a full retrospective. But you will never find it hard for Robert or I to go, well, the 19th Compass story is probably the one with the Black Pirate and the Lost Gold. Like, it's always a joy, and at this point basically a hobby, to spin new Compass pitches.
Right.
Yeah, there will always be, I suspect, even if we write one of these a year until we're 90, stuff that we leave on the cutting room floor, because it's just how we tend to go. That's not to say we're fonts of perfect ideas or anything like that, but we just keep spinning. And some of those would doubtless, if we wrote them, be terrible. But that's why they end up on the cutting room floor as you go, is that, you know, Shader and the mystery of the Outer Hebrides werewolf may or may not ever see the light of day, but they'll always be there, at least in the melange of influences and stuff as we put it together.
What I can say is, if you do want a sense for that sort of thing, one of the new things added at the back of the trade is well worth checking out for what the future of Compass may look like.
Yeah, there's clues in the trade. Clues, I say. But we'll also, yeah, a lot of that depends on what the availability of our collaborators are and when we'll see it next, and ultimately, not to be mercenary about it, you know, trade sales and stuff like that all has an impact on how quickly it comes back or how much it becomes a fan fiction project for Dave and I when we have lunch to talk about what might have been.
Yeah, I imagine that trade sales are a different beast to comic sales, because, you know, comic people who go into a shop, you know, every month and purchase things are a different breed to people who walk into a bookshop and go, oh, that looks interesting.
Correct. So, you know, one of the things we've done over the course of this process is, after being guests on your show, we were invited to our first digital convention appearance, and we turned up at LibraryCon, which is the convention in the US for librarians, unsurprisingly, but also therefore drives stuff like book sales to libraries and things like that. And it was very gratifying. Image does a junket and takes a lot of different people. But we got an opportunity to engage with people who are driven by the book market and who are driven by, you know, what's going on with audiences outside the direct market like that. And that was just great. Not only because it's great to roll up to a room full of librarians and go, this is our story about the equivalent of a two-fisted librarian and why they're the best people on earth, and watch the ripple kind of move through the audience, but also because, you know, it's great to get a sense of that wider approach and what resonates with people and what doesn't. You know, people who wouldn't get the giant penny gag, but nevertheless can get something out of the story, as it were. Some of them will definitely get the giant penny gag. This is not librarians don't love comics. They do. And that's obvious because they let the entire comics industry turn up for a couple of days and do pitches to them. And they're great at moving those books out. But just, you know, as you say, it's a very different beast to roll into a public library and start looking at stuff than it is to sometimes move into the direct market storefront and go, well, what should I be looking at, and everything else.
I don't think you're going to offend all the librarians listening who, you know, don't understand Batman or do understand Batman.
You never know.
Foolish librarians thinking the penny's got something to do with Two-Face.
Yeah.
And as far as different ideas for different types of comics, I mean, is Compass all that you're focusing on, or are you, you know, developing other things? I know you're both sci-fi fans, and, you know, is there anything you want to, you know, tease about anything else?
So there's always four or five projects on the go at once where we're saying we should do something with this. I mean, it comes down to bandwidth and capacity and speed, right? So our first priority is getting more Compass out into the world. But as we said, there's so many factors that sit on that. So yeah, there's always other ideas that we're playing around with. There's a few things that have been in Mothballs for a little while, which we sort of want to unpack, and then you stumble across new things too. I don't want to give too much away in the sense that there's nothing, only in the sense that there's nothing definitive to point to where I'd be like, oh, this is what's coming next and you should all be excited for it. But I guess a broader watch this space, there will certainly be the thing that is not Compass will not be like Compass. We're not just going to write historical adventures for the rest of our career. So certainly the next thing could be very different, and hopefully people enjoy the voice enough to follow that along where it may lead.
So that you've got a sex romp story in a building inside you.
I mean, part of me would love. It's interesting to say that you say that, in that it's probably not something that we would necessarily write, but the degree to which comics as a genre has moved away from doing comedy. In the 60s, it was so massive to do young romance and stuff. Like, yeah, there's Jack Kirby romance comics and stuff like that float around out there. But even, you know, the ubiquity of stuff like the Archies, for a long time, doing gags in comics was huge. And you still obviously get funny stuff, and you even get good old-fashioned kind of sex romp comedies now. And some of those are drawn with much more sensitivity, thankfully, than the bawdy kind of stuff of the 70s and 80s were. But one of the things that we were talking about at LibriCon is that the genre, the medium can certainly embrace very wide genres, and in our view should embrace more than some of the stuff that it currently does. And so we may not write it, but I'd love to see it if somebody wants to do a long form. As I said, there's already some great ones out there, so I don't want to suggest that it's not being done, but more of that's always good. More content that is different is always good, even if we as fans of the comic book medium therefore also tend to write, like you said, we're sci-fi guys, we'll write in that idiom, we write fantasy stuff and detective stories and all those things that tend to hit the big notes for the market. But more variety is always good.
Yeah, it's more the extent of what manga is capable of, you know, the fact that there's a manga for every type of, you know, story you've never thought of already.
I mean, but that's a really key point, right? And I shouldn't, you're right in saying that I shouldn't have excluded the Japanese market in that sense, or the manga-related market, let's put it that way. Because, you know, there's people who are embracing the absolute width of the medium. You know, one of my favorite, I talk about this a lot, one of my favorite things about comics in general is that it's very rare to have something that is both a visual medium, but that also your budget is limited only by your imagination. So it's not like writing screenplays where you've got to go, what can I get done in 10 million or less, or 50 million or less, or whatever, or how am I going to get the studios to disgorge $1 billion of CGI money to get things to happen. You can tell Justin we want a dinosaur in a subterranean pit over a 5th century cauldron discovered by 13th century adventurers. And he goes, yeah, sure. Up you go. And so one of the things that manga does, as you say, is embraces the possibility not only of any genre of story that you might be able to contemplate, but also literally any concept that you might be able to contemplate. Oh, this is a domestic comedy about somebody with a planet for a head, and we will see all the people who live on that planet and what's going on with their lives. And also it's a legal drama about whether or not a whole planet head can do it. You know, all these kind of ideas that are ludicrous on their face. And I mean that in the best possible sense, become realized, and they go, no, here's 120 volumes of Planet Head, The Unbinding. and you know, if that was out there, I would read it. Because it's, That's one of the beauties of the medium, right, is that you can do anything. And one of the things I like about both Eastern and Western comics is they do it. Even superhero comics, and I'm probably monopolizing Dave's times here, but
I see my time.
So one of the things that we both love best about superhero comics, probably the thing that and I'm only saying this because we've talked about it on and off for nearly two decades now, is that one of the strengths of that as a genre is that it's absolutely willing to just smash elements together and say, no, this is going to work by sheer force of will. And then as a cherry on top, grind emotional resonance out of that. Like, you know, there are really touching scenes in superhero comics between a Viking and the ghost of a cowboy. And you're like, oh God, I'm crying at their relationship between the ghost of the cowboy and the Viking and the fight that they had over some guy in purple tights trying to throw the Statue of Liberty into the moon. And like, I genuinely think that's great and smart and beautiful that they're unafraid to go, you know, this is a Western comic and this is a sci-fi comic and this is a fantasy comic and we're going to have to smash all those together to make a superhero comic. And that's great. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that I wasn't involved in the creation of Fantastic Four, because I'm not sure if I would, you know, someone would have pitched, Jack would have pitched the Silver Surfer, and I would have gone, it's a bit weird.
But that's, I mean, that's great, isn't it? That's what that's what gets me excited, is that you can just go, no, this is, you're going to get something strange now. And you know, this has come up on interviews we've done before, and so I want to say it carefully. With absolutely no disrespect to people who are working in the medium today, I think there's a lot of great stuff that's being produced, right? One of my big fears about what can or may happen with the big two in general is that the last thing you want to be doing is constantly rearranging the deck chairs on the ship. The great energy of comics, what made them one of the best things out there, is the willingness to bring the new rather than to just move the pieces of the old, is that you could always add something else to the crazy collection of spinning plates. And, you know, the only extent that I would give advice to anybody is that for my money as a reader, you can always chuck another plate. And I like watching the balancing act of seeing them go. New is almost always exciting in a way that because it adds to the possibility of future payoff than just moving around familiar pieces than we've seen before.
It's sedimentary layers, right? Like, whatever was popular in the 40s is in superhero comics to stay. Whatever was popular in the 50s is in superhero comics to stay. And I think the important thing for our era is whatever's popular here in, gosh, it's terrifying to say 2022, but that's when we live. You know, we should be adding that sedimentary layer, pulling in the things that are in our culture and our world and adding them to superhero comics so that they'll be there for the next 40, 50 years as part of that big canvas.
Wow. Awesome. Well, as was said earlier, the trade for Compass will be out on the, I think it's the 19th of January, or January 19, or, yeah. But that will be in the shops. It's reasonably priced. Go get it. It's a beautiful design by Eric Troutman, a man I greatly admire. His, oh God, I'm so sick of it vibe on Twitter.
He'd be a great guest if you can get him, because that man has some stories. I don't know to what extent he'd be willing to tell them all in a public fashion, but, you know, the Twitter persona barely scratches the surface of the battle-hardened warrior and yet incredibly sweet and generous guy that is Eric Troutman. The man, the mystery.
Yeah. But yeah, go out and buy the trade. I recommend it. I'm going to be buying the trade. That's going on my shelf. I've got the others in the box, but I can do both. It's much easier to lend people a trade, I've found, and it's much easier to reread a trade. Yeah, but I hope this is just, you know, the start of a wave building for these two gentlemen and what they're doing in comics. So please check it out. I think you will enjoy it very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having us again. It's been fun.
No worries. And we will, you know, continue to check in on your careers as they evolve. And, you know, we'll do the episode when you're the new writers on Wonder Woman or Batman or something.
Your lips to God's ears, but we're always happy to come back. Even if that's so your audience can tolerate us going off on tangents, we have nothing new to talk about. We're here when you call.